Hello, everyone. In front of me is Daniel G, who, of course, is a partner in the sports group at Sheringham's, the media and technology law firm. You work with a variety of clubs, players, agents. You help them and advise them on takeovers, transfers, contract negotiations, endorsement deals, reputation management. That's an interesting one. Disciplinary broadcasting and dispute issues. You have written books. Don Deal was the first one. And your latest career book, Build the Invisible, which we'll touch on. And as well as posting blog articles on your own website, which is www.danielg.com. I've read you on the BBC, or seen you or heard you, BBC, ITV, Sky Sports, BT Sports, or TNT now, CNN and Bloomberg. And you have a couple of podcasts going, the Dan and Omar Show, and also a series of interviews in Build the Invisible. Let's go back to the beginning. I started talking to you when you decided to make the jump that you're going to describe now. Go on. Why did you get into football business, and where were you coming from?
You know, I grew up in Liverpool. I was Liverpool Football Club mad. I grew up basically reading the newspapers every day I could. And then in those days, it was the Liverpool Echo and the Daily Post, that you all know. But there was only maybe one page of football news at the most. Nowadays, obviously, there is infinite content, and, you know, you can never be satisfied by the amount of stuff that you can read, consume, or watch. And my idea at the time was just to try and find something that I could speak and talk and listen to around the football and sports industry. But the long play was, a lot of my family were lawyers. My dad was a lawyer, my uncle is a lawyer, my cousins, my aunties are lawyers. So it felt like an easy starting position, even though probably at the beginning I didn't want to be a lawyer and I probably wanted to be a football agent, as many people do as well. But I actually then realized that probably I could get the skills from a law degree and the skills from working in lots and lots of different sectors, and slowly but surely build up knowledge. And we can talk about that in due course, about the sports industry, how you go about doing that. I started trying to build a network and relationships by, you know, meeting people, going to conferences, asking for coffees, asking for advice. And slowly but surely, then you develop a bit of a reputation for knowing particular topics. My first topic that I sort of got familiar with, or a small micro reputation with, was third party ownership, Tevez and Mascherano matters, and FFP around PSG and Man City back in the day when those regulations started. And we're gonna talk about that in due course too. And slowly but surely, then I developed relationships with some of the biggest agents within particular agencies. And luckily, because of my legal training and skills, did a good job for them. And as you know, in the football industry and in the sports industry, if you maintain a good relationship, you develop good trust with them, you get good outcomes. Generally, they come back to you because everybody in different ways needs lawyers to be able to help with, usually, and unfortunately, sometimes difficult situations.
You make it sound so easy. You go for a coffee and you just start working in the business industry, in the football industry. I'm sure it wasn't like that. In fact, I know it wasn't like that, but let's stay there for a little bit. So you don't know anybody, or you know few people. Right. Certainly, you know people in the law business, but didn't you feel like out of your comfort zone? What kind of conversations would you have with those people, and how did you manage to get hold of them?
I tried to do one or two very, very simple things. Part of my initial strategy was to build knowledge in the football industry. So read every single case in the football industry and sports industry I could, understand everything that was going on, spend hours researching, blogging, speaking to people. But the way that helped in a lot of different ways is whenever I read an article or a piece of content, and I think it happened for you with you as well, whenever I read your fantastic work, I would just send the author an email saying, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this for this particular reason. I didn't know that, or I didn't know that, without any request for anything as a result. And I know maybe it sounds corny or reactive, but kindness and giving compliments and being positive and being proactive has probably been one of the most important things that I have been able to tune into, especially at the beginning of my career, where in truth, I didn't have anything to offer. And I think then what everybody also sometimes misunderstands is by starting the relationship, you immediately make the request of the other person that is difficult for the other person to do. So a lot of the time when everyone says, please, dear Daniel, I really want to be a football lawyer, please give me work experience, it's very difficult for me to be able to do that for all of the usual reasons you can expect. And so one particular area of the book, which I've seen work very well with lots and lots of different people, is what I call how to flip the conversation and how to get to yes. And the idea, which I know that you're familiar with as well, is work out actually what the other person needs and what the other person would find of value. And if you can do that, instead of saying, please, can I have work experience if you want to be a sports lawyer, or please let me work for your great football agency because I want to be a football agent, you flip the conversation. You've already started having a little bit of a dialogue, and then you say, I don't need to work for you. I don't need to come into your office. But how about, because I'm based in France and I speak three languages, let me go and do sporting scouting reports on the best up and coming under 18 year olds. And what I'll try and do is let you know how those conversations go potentially. And if anything comes of it, let me introduce you to their parents or something. Every time, the agent will almost certainly say yes. Give a solution to somebody or give an idea which doesn't create a lot of pressure or time for that person, but also incentivizes them to say yes. And they will always say yes. It's always the difficult thing is working out what it is.
That's a brilliant piece of advice. While you were talking, I was thinking of the kind of emails I get myself. I'm sure you do too. And you already mentioned some tend to be of two kinds. One is give me a bit of advice. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want to do. I don't know what kind of advice you're after. But it finishes there. And the other one is, can I do some work for you? Or do you know anybody that needs work? And it's like, you know, I'm busy in my life. I'm not going to be looking for work for you. While at the same time, by pure intuition, but it's what you basically are asking for, I'm talking everywhere I can about Beaglesford United. Which is the club I'm the chairman of. Yes. Now, the idea is not so much come and join us because that's what I want you to do. It's because if you actually ask the relevant questions and you get involved, I'm going to help you. If I see that you're consistent, there is the possibility of working for the guys that do my social media. If you do that well enough, my agent always looks for people that are clever and sharp and have got the right energy and an attitude. That is the way. But let's go to the present. What is a day in the life of Daniel G like?
Well, it just depends. So as you know well, whenever we speak, if it's in the transfer window, it can literally be like this. There are days where you're waiting for things to happen, that you need to clear your time for when the thing happens, and then you are reactive to everything. So in some of the bigger deals that we were doing over the summer, things were going on for 3 months is the truth. And, you know, everybody only sees the newspaper story right at the end and says the big deal that's been done, ever many million and whatever the wages and image rights and agents fees and whatever else it might be. But I'm, you know, as you know as well, it is the exception to the rule that a deal actually gets done. For every deal that gets done, probably about 20 don't, is the truth. So I'm always really, really worried and conscious that as the lawyer, making sure I don't mess up any deals that are going to be done or not. But outside of the window, you know, as you said in the sort of bio in the beginning, I will do a vast array of most legal matters for footballers and agents. So it might be a boot deal. It might be a brand ambassador deal. It might be a dispute. It might be a disciplinary matter. We've seen loads of betting issues going on at the moment. We see lots of other disciplinary issues that crop up. It might be things to do with reputation management, as we said, stories in the press or otherwise. It might be that some of our players are investing in particular companies that I will also help with too. So, and then on the flip side, I also work with quite a lot of high net worth individuals who will buy into football franchises, sports franchises. So they'll be buying in selling particular clubs, for example. And those projects obviously take a little bit longer to fruition.
This conversation is full of jewels of knowledge and experiences, which I think people will appreciate because students haven't got there yet, but they'll find themselves in situations similar to yours or mine. But now let's jump into Sky Sports News. I give you a call, producer gives you a call, I'm the presenter of the show, and there is a bunch of things that people don't know much about, so I'm going to ask you. So we've got with us Daniel G of Sharing Dance, who's going to clarify some of these doubts that we all have. We don't know really enough about financial fair play, our wage cap, about why the Premier League is going ahead from the rest of Europe. So Daniel, I hope you can help us with it, starting with financial fair play. Where are we with that at the moment? Is it the perfect system, you feel?
Well, I think you can probably take it in about two or three different directions. But to your question, I think you have to go back almost 12 or 13 years to FFP's inception. You have European clubs in over 1.5 billion euros worth of debt and losses. You have a situation whereby owners are having to fund huge amounts of losses, and there is no sustainability in European football. So UEFA's quite transformative approach was to try and put some type of loss-making prohibitions in place. Now, I always like to differentiate between were those loss-making mechanisms in place for the good of the game? I would say yes, because actually behaviorally we see the trend of huge reductions in losses over a 10-year, 12-year period now in European football. But what you see at the same time, which is the controversial elements, is the likes of Manchester City and PSG and others that look like at different times they may have been in breach of the rules and then not being punished or not being punished as severely as everyone suggests. So there is always that distinction on whether the aims of the rules have actually fulfilled an important part. I would say yes, but in some instances, some clubs and some owners would say actually the implementation of the sanctions hasn't been as sustainable or as useful as others. Now, the evolution now has come where UEFA don't even call the rules the FFP rules anymore. They're called the sustainability rules because they would argue there's nothing fair play about that. And as you mentioned, in the last couple of weeks, Steve Parrish of Crystal Palace has talked about potential salary caps. And would those salary caps be as a percentage of revenue? Would they be a hard cap as an amount of money? Ultimately, what we are talking about is two very specific things. One is how do we make clubs more sustainable so they're not making huge losses? And the second is actually thinking about competitive balance, which is how do we ensure that the product, the attractiveness of the product, be that the Premier League or the Champions League, creates uncertainty of outcome to have fantastic games of football and to make sure that on any given game you're not sure who's going to win or not. And they are the two levers that UEFA and the Premier League are always thinking about, for example.
And you've made my very convoluted question a very clear answer in people's minds. They know all of a sudden much more than they knew 3 minutes ago. But I'll continue with the conversation as if we were in Sky Sports News, and I'll say, right, you're talking about wage cap. Is that the solution to get a more balanced environment in which, you know, competition is at the forefront of everything, and you get, say, in Europe, the likes of Bruges or Ajax winning again, or in the case of the Premier League, Brighton winning the league? Is that possible, or is that gone forever?
Well, I think there is a very, very important question about how you measure competitive balance. So when I mean by competitive balance, I mean, are we saying Manchester City or Liverpool or Arsenal or Man United or Chelsea winning the league every year or every other year? Or are we talking about the fact that on any particular match day, one team might beat another team? Or are we simply saying in a lot of the top five leagues, for example, we effectively know that Bayern Munich have got a very good chance of winning the Bundesliga. We know that PSG are almost certainly going to win Liga. We almost certainly know that probably Barca or Real Madrid are going to win the Spanish League as well. La Liga. We got there in the end. The question then becomes, how do you increase the possibility of attractive games on a weekly basis, so that in the end, the product becomes more interesting for more people, necessarily outside of the fans of those clubs. And one weapon or ability mechanism to use is wage caps, as we've seen in US sport. You try and create better competitive balance by equalizing the resources of all the participants. Now, you've still got to ensure that those participants use those resources well. But at the same time, you want to make sure that you don't reduce innovation, you don't stifle incentives to grow revenues or to reduce cost bases. So I always think cost control is only one lever of a bigger idea for how you deal with competitive balance. And as you can see in the Premier League at the moment, some would argue, myself included, competitive balance has increased quite considerably, whereas you would argue in the past, maybe it's only two or three teams that you would know would get into the Champions League on a regular basis. Now you would say there's a depth of possibly seven, eight teams that could be challenging for Champions League. And bear in mind as well, Champions League this year is potentially five Premier League teams going for those places. So that in itself becomes an interesting competitive balance discussion on a national level, but also on a European level too.
I will talk to you for another half an hour, 2 hours. But part of the key of a good conversation is to finish it a little bit too early, which is what we're about to do. So, Daniel, it's been a total pleasure to chat to you. We've learned a lot. I'm sure the students have as well. And I'm glad that this has been recorded to be kept for the online students and for future years, because everything we discussed today will continue to be relevant for years to come. So thank you very much for your time.
We hope you've enjoyed today's conversation and took away some valuable insights and lessons. If you'd like to learn more about the strategies and mindset discussed on the show, be sure to check out the book, my book, Build the Invisible, and the accompanying BTI journal, both available at www.buildtheinvisible.com. We also encourage you to leave us a review and subscribe to keep up to date on future episodes. Thanks for listening.